From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, actor Kevin Spacey faces a felony charge in a Nantucket court.
Mr. Fowler, this complaint charges that in the town of Nantucket on July 8th, 2016, did commit indecent assault and battery on person 14 or over.
Also today, after more than 6 months, National Grid's lockout of more than 1,200 gas workers is over.
It hasn't been easy on us, and maybe more so to our spouses, our kids have suffered during the whole thing.
And no end in sight for the shutdown.
A wall is an immorality. It's not who we are as a nation.
Steel is stronger than concrete. If I build this wall or fence or anything the Democrats need to call it.
So what should each side give to reach a deal? Plus, flu season is here, and one expert says it's time to get your flu shot. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. After half a year out of work, the more than 1,200 gas workers locked out by National Grid have a new contract. Union leaders and representatives from the company reached a tentative agreement last week on a deal that would replace the contract that expired in June when negotiations broke down. And today, a majority of the membership of the locked-out unions approved the negotiated contract in separate votes. Joe Curlo is the president of one of those locked-out unions.
Clearly, it's a weight lifted off everybody's shoulders. And when I do say everybody, it's all the people that worked will be able to go back and provide a living for their families.
WBUR's Bruce Gellerman has followed the contract dispute and resulting lockout since June and was at the first union vote today. Bruce, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Cal.
Also joining us by phone is Professor Robert Forent. He's a professor of labor history at UMass Lowell. Professor, you welcome also back to Radio Boston.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So, Bruce, you were at the meeting hall in Dorchester today, which I understand was a bit of a wild goose chase to find it, but find it you did, and the union negotiated the contract, ratified it this morning. What was that scene like?
Well, it was a lot like a tailgate party at a football game in the parking lot. Yeah, so it was kind of fun outside, and then it was much more serious inside. There were hundreds of people milling around this meeting hall, waiting for the vote count to see how it turned out. There were representatives of National Grid. There were no representatives of National Grid there. But, you know, there was anticipation and then relief and then the sense of now what? It was because there was a lot of unknowns. This contract is over a half an inch in depth, so it's a lot going on in this contract.
Thick stack of paper there.
A lot of going on there.
So a lot in there. And one of the things that was striking, Bruce, even though the negotiated tentative deal was last week, we didn't have any leaks over the weekend of what was actually in the thing. So what actually do we know now after they've voted?
Yeah, the union and utility really had this tight. They really kept the lid on it. It was very, very impressive, actually, in some ways, because I've been following it very closely. So what's in it is a couple of things. One is starting soon this week, they're going to start what they call onboarding people who are locked out and getting them recertified for those credentials they need to do certain jobs. Everybody's going to be back on the job by January 20th. And but, you know, in the contract itself, there were a lot of concessions. The big concession on the part of the unions was that new hires are going to not get the same retirement plan, the pension that old workers have gotten. That's a big one. But the union was able to claw back a lot of things in there so that these union workers will get longer health care after they wind up leaving the company. They'll have higher raises. They're going to get like 27% over the next 5.5 years. So there was, you know, increased life insurance benefits, sick benefits beefed up. So there's a lot of give and take in this.
And we heard also from some union workers who, you know, they're happy to see the end of it, right? But they're not exactly thrilled. This wasn't a unanimous vote, right?
It wasn't a unanimous vote. It was like 560-something or other to 125 against. I spoke with a guy named Joe Faraday. He was a 10-year veteran of National Grid. He actually voted against the contract, but he says he recognized the difficulties that the bargainers faced in the negotiation process.
The committee and the union did absolutely the best that they could, and they fought as hard as they could for the next generation, for the new workers coming in. You know, it was a fair compromise overall.
Yeah, but, you know, it was a grueling. That's one of the words that people use. Mentally grueling, you know, here you had kind of a David and Goliath situation. You had this local unions, steel workers, and a multinational company with billions in revenues. So, you know, even for people who didn't like the end result, they feel they fought hard for the benefits, and they obviously overwhelmingly voted support it.
Professor Forent, let me bring you into the conversation. You've also been following this contract dispute closely, and I wonder if you could sort of help play referee here, because I feel like we're in the spin room after a debate. You know, both sides are going to say that they won. So in your view, who actually won this negotiation?
I think in the near term, at least, again, until we can fully see what's inside the document, I actually think the union came out ahead. I went back through my files and looked at originally what National Grid said it wanted back when they locked the workers out, and they had to compromise on a good deal of it. They also had to agree to add new jobs that had been outsourced before. So there's about, I think, 45, at least from what I've been able to see so far, 45 to 50 new hires, which is significant. A lot of the things that they wanted to take away from new workers, some of those things are put in place, but not in the incredibly negative way that they wanted them. And so I think the fact that the company used the lockout for 6 months to try to completely overhaul a union contract, and in many respects, from the labor side, gut a lot of the principles of the contract, I don't think that National Grid can walk around thinking that they succeeded.
So, Bruce, Professor Forent says the union actually came out ahead here, but I'm mindful of the fact that these workers went months without their health insurance and paychecks. I mean, what was the toll like for them and their families?
Well, you know, some of it was mitigated because they had unemployment insurance, and then the main union, the steelworkers union, actually helped them pay some of them their health benefits. But I did speak to one of them, one worker. Her name was Terry Davis, and she said you know, she didn't think it was going to last that long, and she said it, you know, really started taking a toll on her health.
It was hard because I had no health care at the beginning. And long story short, and I'm not afraid to tell anyone, I became diabetic and on insulin when they shut off the insurance and I didn't have anything and wound up almost paying out of pocket $800 for insulin for 30 days.
Cal, you hear a lot of stories like that when, you know, everybody has a story. So it's, you know, well, there were 1,250 locked out workers. You know, the impact was very real on these people and their families.
And Professor Forent, you know, there was a lot of political pressure during this process to get a deal done, especially recently. You know, at one point in the fall, you had the Department of Public Utilities placing a 10-week moratorium on new gas work by National Grid. That was after an overpressurization incident in Woburn. And then more recently, the legislature passed a bill that would have put National Grid on the hook for the workers' unemployment benefits going forward. So did that pressure ultimately make the difference here?
I think the pressure helped a little bit, but I think that the fact that National Grid went to the dramatic step that they did of locking the workers out. So this is not a strike in the normal sense of the company wants to stay open or whatever and the workers are walking away. This is the company locking those workers out, cutting the health insurance, impacting the people, as we just heard. I'm actually, frankly, surprised that there was not more political pressure put on National Grid, but I think this is a sign of the times of more and more of public utilities and other services like this being sort of gobbled up by bigger outside corporations who don't necessarily share the same pain. If this had been a locally owned utility, it probably would have felt the weight of the legislature a bit more than it did in this particular case.
Bruce, do the workers feel that? I mean, do they wish that they had gotten more help from public officials to put pressure on?
They were putting pressure on the DPU from the very start and showing videos of things they alleged that there were work hazards in there being done by replacement workers. But I think when Governor Weld at the very end of December signaled that he was going to sign an extension of unemployment benefits, that was really it, because then it could have gone on another half year and nobody wanted that. And the union was going to have to pay, not the union, the utility was going to have to pay for that.
Governor Baker, of course.
Yes.
We're flashing way back here now.
Where did I go?
To Governor Weld.
Oh, my gosh.
You're showing your age, Bruce.
I just saw the red hair flash before
me. we'll jump in that river when we get to it.
Thank you both, gentlemen. That is WBUR's Bruce Gellerman, who's been following this story for months now. Bruce, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
And thanks also to Professor Robert Forent, a professor of labor history at UMass Lowell.
Thanks.
Thank you. Actor Kevin Spacey appeared in a Nantucket courtroom today, facing a single felony count of indecent assault and battery. The charge stems from a 2016 encounter at an upscale bar on the island, where Spacey allegedly groped the son of a former Boston TV anchor. Spacey's attorney entered a plea of not guilty on his behalf. Here's the clerk reading the charges against Spacey, whose real name is Kevin Fowler, and Judge Thomas Barrett setting the conditions for release.
Okay, Mr. Fowler, this complaint charges that in the town of Nantucket on July 8th, 2016, did commit indecent assault and battery on person 14 or over.
Sir, if you're charged with another offense while this matter is open, you can be held for 90 days without bail.
Joining me now from Nantucket is Boston Herald reporter Sean Cotter. Hello, Sean.
Hi there. How you doing?
So, watching the live stream, Sean, it looked like quite a scene. What was it like there, and what actually happened of substance today? What was decided today at the arraignment?
So, in the arraignment, Kevin Spacey was formally charged with, as you said, one count of indecent assault and battery. And, I mean, effectively, it's a pretty short hearing. He is charged. He entered the plea. He actually didn't say anything at this hearing, but a plea was entered for him of not guilty, and they released him on his own recognizance with the instructions to stay away from the alleged victim.
Spacey has faced a number of accusations of sexual misconduct, so remind us, Sean, if you would, the details of this case. This, as we said at the top, stems from an encounter at a Nantucket restaurant in July of 2016. So remind us what this particular victim is alleging happened that night.
Yeah, this is the person making the accusation is the son of former WCVB anchor Heather Unruh, and folks may remember that she and family's lawyer held a press conference about 14 months ago, talking about how saying that Spacey had bought her then 18-year-old son a handful of drinks, and eventually put his hands down the teenager's pants.
And as you said, Sean, it was a very brief, less than 10-minute hearing today, but the thing that really stood out, I think, was the back and forth about how long the alleged victim here should have to preserve the data on his cell phone. And ultimately, Judge Thomas Barrett ruled that the cell phone data for about 6 months after this encounter must be preserved. And here's the defense attorney, Alan Jackson, explaining why he wants to see those text messages that the alleged victim sent during that period.
This is data that we believe is not only potentially exculpatory, but likely exculpatory for Mr. Spacey. I simply don't want to see any of that data deleted, destroyed, even inadvertently, or in other words, in any other way manipulated.
Likely exculpatory. Sean, what's he getting at there? I mean, what do you think Spacey's lawyers believe might be in those messages?
So what they are getting at there, they spell out a lot further in the motions that they filed today as well. They're basically saying that they expect that text messages and Snapchats from those days and afterwards will show basically that that the teenager didn't consider this a big deal, and the lawyer says this pretty directly, that his mother is the one who's really pushing this.
We saw some of that, too, in the transcript of the December 20th hearing that went on behind closed doors last month, where the defense was sort of highlighting particular details that it was the young man who had approached Kevin Spacey, that he had allegedly lied about his age, saying he was 23 and not 18, and that he allowed this encounter to go on for multiple minutes and didn't complain. I mean, is this what the playbook is going to be, Sean, from the defense, that this was a consensual encounter and nothing more?
It certainly seems like it. Again, I was looking at those motions that were filed today, and Spacey's Los Angeles-based attorney, Alan Jackson, the one who was there speaking earlier that we just heard, he doesn't really contest that they actually met, that the teenager came up to Spacey, and he basically says what happened was a consensual flirtation between the two.
And how did Kevin Spacey appear in court today, Sean? I mean, you mentioned that he didn't say anything during the proceedings, but he was also surrounded by a throng of reporters as he was coming out of the courthouse. Did he say anything at all to the press?
He said nothing. He gave us a big smile as he was driven away in the SUV that he came in. But other than that, there was no interaction with us.
And how would you describe his demeanor throughout the whole proceeding?
Calm, quiet. I mean, he stood there quietly in the courtroom for a little bit and then took a seat as they went back and forth about the text messages.
So nothing from Spacey today, but he has sort of talked indirectly about this on social media. I want to play a small part of a cryptic video where Spacey portrays his House of Cards character, Frank Underwood, in a video that he posted just last month. Let's take a listen.
If it was all so simple, only you and I both know it's never that simple, not in politics and not in life. But you wouldn't believe the worst without evidence, would you? You wouldn't rush to judgments without facts, would you? Did you?
So, Sean, we have this sort of public posting here on social media from Kevin Spacey, and yet we also had this apparent attempt reported by the Boston Globe this weekend to keep things very quiet. We understand that Kevin Spacey had the opportunity to appear at an unannounced mini-trial hearing, a secret court setting, if you will. These hearings are typically used to assess if there's enough evidence to bring charges. Suspects only have a legal right to them in misdemeanor cases. This, of course, is a felony case. So, Sean, there seems to be sort of this tension here where, on the one hand, he's trying to speak publicly through social media and yet also trying to keep the proceedings very quiet and not have to appear in court himself at all. What do we make of that conflict?
It's hard to say. A bunch of defense attorneys who I was talking to about it over the past couple of weeks said that that certainly wouldn't be the strategy that they would suggest.
The social media strategy.
I'm putting out the video. Yeah, exactly. And as well as, I mean, there was a report, I want to say about a week ago, that I think it was the Daily Mail found where he was staying in Baltimore, and he came out and brought them a pizza and had this hat that said retired in 2017. And so, yeah, I mean, there is a little bit of a tension, it seems, between the natural desire of the defense to keep things sort of as contained as possible and what seems to be his desire to speak about it.
There is. And of course, there's the broader Me Too context. And we've got men like Spacey who have faced professional ramifications. But his case is interesting because he's one of the few to actually face criminal charges. So there's a lot to still follow here. That's Boston Herald reporter Sean Cotter. Sean, thanks for joining us from Nantucket.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, is there a compromise to be made over the wall and the shutdown? I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. We're now well into day 16 of a partial government shutdown, and there doesn't seem to be a compromise in sight. Talks over the weekend between congressional Democrats and the White House yielded no concrete results, or steel, as the case may be. And the president announced today that he'll address the nation from the Oval Office tomorrow night to discuss what he says is a crisis on the southern border. Trump has doubled down on his request for a $5.7 billion amount to fund a promised border wall, even suggesting he might use emergency powers to have the military build it. And here's what White House advisor Mercedes Schlapp said, speaking with reporters earlier today. She said the Democrats need to stop what she's calling their delay tactics.
This is what it's about. It's about a negotiation. The Democrats themselves have said the importance of securing the border. I heard Nancy Pelosi. I heard Chuck Schumer. They said it. They said, yes, we agree we need to secure the border. They have yet to provide the definition of border security. Even the president was saying, because Nancy kept getting stuck on the wall, on the concrete wall, and the president's like, look, let's look into steel. Come with me. Let's work together to come up with a design. Let's work with our Border Patrol agents to come up with a design that works.
Nancy there, of course, is the new House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and she and Democrats said yesterday that they are not backing down. Open the government first, and then we'll talk.
We are committed to keeping our border safe. That has always been our principle, to honor the oath of office that we take to protect and defend our country and our Constitution. We can do that best when government is open. We've made that clear to the president.
So what's this all about? Can the president deliver on his campaign promise of building the wall? And can Democrats fulfill their promises coming out of the midterms? Well, joining us now to talk it over is Eric Fernstrom, founder and principal of the Shamit Group. He's a political consultant and a longtime former top aide to Mitt Romney. Eric, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Also with us from NPR in Washington is Scott Ferson. He's a Democratic strategist and president of the Liberty Square Group. Scott, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, we'd like to hear from you on this as well. In your view, is there a compromise to be reached in Washington? Do you support building the wall? And how should Democrats and Republicans come together? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. All right, Eric, let me start with you. What's your read of this impasse in Washington as it stands right now?
Well, Callum, I think the problem is that we have a highly charged political atmosphere in Washington. We're already knee-deep in the 2020 presidential election cycle. There are a number of Democratic senators running. The president, very early on, announced his candidacy for re-election. So since we're in campaign mode and not governing mode, we have a prescription for stalemate. Now, the idea of a fence or a wall or a barrier of some kind on the southern border is not a new one. Democrats have supported it in the past, but in this hyper-politicized environment, they don't want to be seen as conceding to the president on one of his main talking points from the 2016 campaign, and Trump, likewise, wants to deliver for his base. So here we are on the third week of the shutdown.
How do you see it, Scott? I mean, what's the battle really about? Is Eric right? Is it just onto politics now? And if so, that sounds like a pretty inauspicious prediction, because we've got 2 years left on this term before the next election.
I know it's going to make the next 2 years very interesting. Of course, it's writ large about politics, but I think the dynamic that's going on here is that you've got because of course there's a compromise to be had here. You pick a number in the middle and do it. We waste lots of money in the federal government on lots of things if you consider the wall to be a waste. And I agree with Eric that there's of course a wall on the border is part of the solution. But I think what you've got here are Democrats, particularly in the House, who think that they have the upper hand. And I frankly would tend to agree with that. And you've got a president who we always talk about his base, but I think his base is actually just what he sees in the mirror. And I think he's just happy as long as the attention is on him with a white-hot intensity and borne by the fact that he's going to address the nation tomorrow night on TV. I think he's just happy as long as he's the center of attention. And therefore, that's where the tension is.
Scott, you say there's a compromise to be had, but I mean, can that really be the case when both sides have laid out such extreme terms? I'm thinking of something that Nancy Pelosi said very recently when she was talking to reporters, and she didn't just say that it's a waste of money or a boondoggle. She used much more severe language. This is what she had to say.
A wall is an immorality. It's not who we are as a nation. And this is not a wall between Mexico and the United States that the president is creating here. It's a wall between reality and his constituents.
And immorality, Scott. I mean, that's pretty strong. I mean, if it's an immorality, then in theory, she shouldn't be willing to give even a dollar for it, right? So how could she possibly compromise from here?
Well, that's where I think it is. I mean, I would tend to agree with that, although now it's questionable as to sort of how effective the wall is in terms of people moving back and forth. But I think the immorality is not handling DACA. That's a real immorality of 2 million people who are here. And because of this kind of noise and nonsense, we can't address that. And if she's serious about it, she would, I think, be pushing for a DACA solution in this budget impasse and get the government opened up. But somehow we're talking about $0 to $5.6 billion with nobody budging from either side.
Eric, how do you read that? Is that a deal that would be on the table? I mean, do you think that this president and the Republicans would exchange DACA for the wall?
Well, I think that's inevitably where we're going to end up. You know, Trump has tried to get the Democrats to compromise on the semantics around the issue. You know, he's willing to stop calling it a wall and use terms like fence. He's willing to use steel instead of concrete. But the Democrats are unmoved. They're not going to concede on the substance. They're certainly not going to concede on the semantics. But if we can get past the politics, I think the solution is to go big on immigration. And by that I mean we need to produce a bill that encompasses a number of immigration-related initiatives that are sought by both sides. So in that context, I think you can give Trump some additional money for a wall. But in return, the Democrats get to enact into law protections for the DACA population. And perhaps, you know, they can win some extensions for those who are here under temporary protected status, but they're going to see that status expire. If we stay fixated on the wall and only the wall, I don't see how we arrive at a compromise at this point, given that both sides are pretty much dug in on their respective positions.
All right, Lewis is calling from Revere, and he says that there's another angle of this that perhaps we're not considering. Lewis, what is that? What might we be missing here?
Okay, what I was saying was, I mean, a wall is really not going to do anything. I mean, we can put a wall as high as we want. We can dig, you know, as many holes as we want. And what we need to change is the law. I mean, a wall, and not only that, I mean, we build a wall, but we got to think about the ecosystem, too. I mean, it's not only people that use, you know, come from Mexico to the U.S. There's an ecosystem that lives on that border, and that, you know, animals need to come back, you know, back and forth. And if we change our law system, I think that will help with the immigration. A wall is not going to do anything if we don't have anyone to secure that wall, to take care of the wall. You know what I mean?
So, Lewis, I take it you're opposed to the idea of the wall. So are you saying then that the president and his supporters are perhaps not accounting for economic damage that would ensue from building the wall?
Yep, I'm against the wall because I don't think the wall is going to work. I think if we change our law, if we change the, you know, the way the law protects the illegal immigrants, I think that will do more than just building a wall and hoping that people are going to just go back because they see a wall.
Lewis, thanks for the call. Scott Ferson, let's pick it up from there. I mean, does Lewis have a point? I mean, is this really more of an economic debate than just one about steel and concrete?
Well, it gets to those larger points that we're talking about, which I think is right. I mean, if we continue to be, for Democrats to be completely fixated on Trump's obsession with the wall, which I think is complete folly, I'd be inclined to let him build it and put his name on it so that we all know that that he owns it. And I think it's, as Lewis mentions, it's not going to really solve the problem there. But if it gives us an opportunity to address the things that he talked about, the larger issues around immigration, the ones that Eric talked about, that would actually be progress. And I think for Democrats who've newly taken the House back to show some leadership on some of those larger issues that maybe Donald Trump isn't focused on because he's so fixated on his wall would be progress. And I think would work to the Democrats' benefit moving forward politically as well.
Interesting. So there's a Democratic argument for perhaps just letting the president have his wall. But I wonder if he can actually claim victory even if he does eventually get the wall. And I want to flash back to something he said on the campaign trail in Akron, Ohio in August of 2016. And he set a very high bar for how this whole wall would play out.
That wall will go up so fast, your head will spin. And you'll say, you know, he meant it. And you know what else I mean? Mexico is going to pay for the wall. 100%.
So, Eric Fernstrom, I mean, what about that? I mean, let's say the president eventually does get his wall. Will that satisfy his base, do you think? Because I think the prospect of Mexico paying seems unlikely at this point. I think most Americans would agree with that. And also, I think we're past the point where you could say that it's gone up so fast that our heads are spinning. So would it still be counted as a win among Trump supporters?
Well, you know, I think it's going to be hard to separate the winners from the losers if this standoff goes on much longer. One of the physical laws of politics is that a crisis requires a response. And while some people may not agree that there's a crisis on the border, certainly if government remains closed much longer, that's going to create a different type of crisis. And while at first the shutdown might have been mildly inconvenient, in other words, some monuments and museums in D.C. were closed. Now we're starting to hear about federal TSA workers who are not getting paid during this shutdown, but they're still required to work, but they're beginning to call in sick. So when people start missing their flights because of long security lines, or hundreds of thousands of federal workers and contractors can't make their rent payments, or start defaulting on their mortgages, or food stamps are no longer available for people who depend on them, public opinion is going to broadly turn against anyone in D.C., whether they're Democrat or Republican. In fact, the worst possible thing to be if you're running for president in the midst of a shutdown like this is going to be your status as an elected office holder.
Although the president says he's been hearing lots of support from federal workers saying, well, hey, don't open the government until you get that wall.
Well, whether your name is Trump or Senator Elizabeth Warren, If this shutdown continues, if it persists, then everybody's goose is going to get cooked. And I think then it's at that point that, a solution will finally emerge.
All right, so listeners, remember, you can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Calling in now is Pat from Sudbury. And, Pat, I understand you agree with Nancy Pelosi on this argument. What does she get right?
Well, that it's an immorality and that that's not what this country stands for. And I don't frankly think that our current president really does stand for this country or the people in it. I think he just cares about his ego and, you know, saving face. And at this point, it's a lose-lose for him and for the country because the wall will not keep us any safer. It's a ridiculous waste of money. It's a ridiculous idea. The whole thing is just laughable because it won't. What we need is to work on the regulations, which Democrats have tried to do. Reasonable people, if they were in our government, would be able to accomplish this. But right now we have an administration, you know, that hopefully now that the Democrats have the House will be a little more reasonable because so far the Republicans haven't had the backbone to stand up to Trump and say and do the right thing for the American people.
Pat, thanks for the call. So she agrees with Nancy Pelosi, but Charlie calling in from Salem says he is for the wall. Charlie, why?
Yeah, I'm for the wall because if you look back in history, walls that have been created between sovereign nations have worked effectively. And, you know, I think that the immigration debate has been ongoing now for nearly most of my life, close to 30 years, and we've done very little to stem the flow of illegal immigrants into this country.
Charlie,
now,
we were just
any legal immigrant.
Sure, sure. I wanted to ask you to sort of put a concrete answer to a question we were sort of having with Scott and Eric a moment ago, which was whether pro-wall supporters would be satisfied if it turns out that we, the taxpayers, are the ones paying for it, and if it takes a while to get done. Is that good enough for you? You're not getting Mexico footing the bill, and it's not going up so fast that your head is spinning.
Yeah, given the cost of illegal immigration to this country every year, a $5 billion price tag to fund the construction of a wall promises a great return on investment.
All right, Charlie, thanks for the call. So Charlie says that a wall at any time, paid for by anybody, would satisfy him. Dave calling from Roslindale, though, says that we're missing a fundamental question. What's that, Dave?
The fundamental question is who stays, who goes, and who gets to come in the future. Until we decide that, a wall small, people will still come. We need to decide the people who are already here, how many of them get to stay. Democrats are unwilling to mention any group because once they do that, they are, you know, viewed as people who are keeping people out. They don't want to say also who will they keep out because, once again, they don't want to do that. Republicans then can't understand want to send everyone home and keep everyone out, which is unrealistic also. So somebody needs to step up and say who will they let in, who will they keep out, and who will they, you know, send home? Until they answer that question, what's the point of a wall?
Dave, thanks for the call. Scott Ferson, let's pick that up. I think Dave makes an interesting point, and this is going to, I assume, become a hot topic of debate during the Democratic primary, which just kicked off this past weekend with Elizabeth Warren traveling to Iowa, by the way. Democrats are going to have to answer that question, right? So what are going to be the terms? You can't let everybody in. So who gets to stay and who has to go? How do you think Democrats are going to reconcile that question?
Well, I think that, I mean, under the Constitution, having Congress debate sort of the immigration policy of the country is where it has to be. So I put, you know, one branch controlled by Republicans, one by Democrats, have to figure out that larger issue that the caller talked about. But I think here, and I think this is where I would make this concession to the caller, what Democrats have been reluctant to do is actually talk about the policies of the, let's say, the Obama administration. You know, I don't think people are running around, and certainly President Obama wasn't, talking about how many people get deported under his administration, but they were as severe as they are under the present administration in a lot of metrics. So there are decisions that are and decisions that are being made every day on who gets to stay and who gets to go. What we lack is the larger one that says this is what our vision is about how we're going to grow. We're in this jobs crisis where we can't find people to come, and unemployment is so low to take these jobs. And how are we going to do that so that we're growing as a country and achieving our economic growth?
Eric, you sort of laid out some of the drawbacks of the shutdown that we're in a little bit earlier, but from a political standpoint, is this a win for the president? I mean, he's coming out of a midterm election where Democrats won the House. Is he managing to overshadow whatever the congressional agenda might be here?
Well, like I said, I think it's going to be hard to separate the winners from the losers. I think they all come out looking bad. I mean, there's no question that the level of attack and vitriol that's existing now in Washington, hasn't previously been experienced. And I'm not just talking about Trump. Of course, he's made his contributions to the level of discourse in our Capitol. But there's also been, you know, of course, the foul language being used on the other side, inept comparisons to Hitler and Nazism. These are not helpful, particularly when you consider that fortifying the border has always been a shared priority of the two major parties. The other thing that's happening, of course, is we have this trade impasse between China and the U.S., and at one time we thought that would never be resolved, and yet both sides are meeting in Beijing this week. There seems to be some optimism around the idea of a negotiated solution. So how did we arrive at that point? And I think it's because one of the parties began to feel some pain, and that's China. So they're now at the table. They want to talk about it. So in a shutdown of indeterminate length, you know, who's going to be feeling the most pain? And I think it's going to be public employee unions. It's going to be advocates for government spending. It's going to be social safety net dependents. And these are all traditionally Democratic constituencies. So it's very hard to get inside the mind of Trump. But as I try to, I tend to believe that this is what he is banking on, these traditional Democratic constituencies are going to feel the most pain from the shutdown. They're going to understand that the president is unmovable on the issue, and they're going to begin to put pressure on the Democrats to end this standoff. Time's going to tell, of course, but that could very well be what the president is banking on.
Eric, you have an ally in Worcester. Mark is calling from the heart of the Commonwealth to agree with something that Eric just said. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, and I do agree with that. Hi, I agree that the people that are supporting Trump will be intractable, but I also see the Democrats as being that way, that it seems to me that a lot of the Democratic base are do anything but give Trump what he wants, and so I don't necessarily see either side moving on that, and I wonder if you guys see any, you know, if the Democrats are intractable and the president's intractable, then how do we get out of this?
So, Scott Fersen, how about that point from Mark? I mean, if the Democrats come out of this looking just as intractable as the president, does that hurt them in 2020?
I don't think so. I think that for Democrats, if we're talking about members of Congress, that if there were a compromise that included, you know, somewhere between the zero and $5.6 billion for the border wall, or Trump would say that it was going to be for the border wall, that I think a lot of Democrats would go for that. I think, though, the pressure from constituency groups, I think, will be to their members of Congress and their senators, which is why I think you see Susan Collins the senator from Colorado start to send messages that they're wavering a little bit. I think they probably are or will start to hear from their constituents, and they may be Democrats, but those are in purple states, and if Mitch McConnell loses a couple of those, I think it will be Mitch McConnell who will be the adult on the Republican side, who will engender a compromise here with Democrats. And I think the beautiful thing, one of the beautiful things about being Donald Trump, must be that he declares victory whether he wins or loses, and convinces himself of it. And I think at some point he will, whatever the compromise is, and whoever sits down and negotiates that with the Democrats, if it's him and his team or Mike Pence or Mitch McConnell, he's going to declare victory and move on to the next thing.
I think declaring victory might be what you'd call the art of the deal there, right, Scott?
There you go.
What kind of deal, though, would the president take? I mean, he seems to have maybe some room for compromise, although it may just be something as simple as what the building materials would be. This is what the president said on Friday. He was talking about his original plan to do it in concrete, says, well, maybe he'd be open to something else.
Steel is stronger than concrete. If I build this wall or fence or anything the Democrats need to call it, because I'm not into names, I'm into production. I'm into something that works. If I build a steel wall rather than a concrete wall, it will actually be stronger than a concrete. Steel is stronger than concrete, okay? In case you could check it out.
Okay, Mike calling from Everett. What about that? I mean, is that enough of a compromise? You say that the president isn't really negotiating. He says, sure, he's negotiating. He might be willing to do steel instead of concrete.
Well, I guess my point is that, I mean, he says that he's a great negotiator, and that's kind of how he sold himself to the American people. But I'm kind of, all I've seen from his negotiating tactics on almost every topic is he's just a bully. He's basically said that he was proud to shut the government down, which means he's basically putting his agenda ahead of the American people or at least the government workers. He's saying that their jobs are not as important as him getting his way. And I personally am really disappointed by that.
All right, Mike, thanks for the call. Last word to you, Scott, first. And, you know, we hear this complaint that the president is perhaps just bullying his way to a victory, not perhaps considering the broader good. I think the last question I think that I'm wondering about is whether this build the wall mantra that he campaigned on and continues now is just sort of a dog whistle to anti-immigrant groups in the United States.
Well, there's, you know, I think there's an argument, obviously, to be made of that. I think personally, I think we should put that aside, that because that's also a larger context of what the directions of the both parties are. But you mentioned the art of the deal, and I think I'm not sure Donald Trump is thinking globally about a lot of these things, and he's just thinking about closing. And even if the deal doesn't go his way, he's going to go out and tell the next audience that it was the best deal that was ever negotiated. So I think he's thinking not thinking strategically in that way.
All right. That's Scott Fersen joining us from NPR in Washington. He's a Democratic strategist and president of the Liberty Square Group. Scott, thanks.
Thank you.
And Eric Fernstrom, founder and principal of the Shamit Group, the political consultant and former longtime top aide to Mitt Romney. Eric, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. The flu is here, people, and cases of the flu are spiking in Massachusetts. And with us to talk about one of our least favorite aspects of winter is Carrie Goldberg, editor of WBUR's Common Health. Hi there, Carrie.
Hey, Callum.
You are the self-described health nag at WBUR, and you're here fittingly with your bottle of Purell.
Yes, so I have my Purell.
I'll try not to
do.
Take offense.
Thank you. Yes, it's not you. And it's a winter ritual of mine to come on the air and say, hey, you know, I'm doing it a little later than I usually do, but it's not too late to get your flu vaccine. And there really is clear medical consensus that even though the vaccine doesn't offer perfect protection, in fact, far from it, it's the best protection that we have.
And your reporting indicates that the need for that protection is rising. So
yes.
What's going on? Are we just more susceptible? Or is the bug getting worse?
No, it's just that we're starting to spike for the year. We have a winter flu season every year. And now first, a quick look back to last winter. So last year, it was a particularly bad flu season. It's estimated that more than 80,000 Americans died,
wow,
including, 180 babies, children, and teenagers. That was the highest number ever. And though the vast majority of deaths were in people over 65, and the dominant strain last season was H3N2, which is a particularly nasty bug.
So, of course, although millions of people get the flu every year without serious consequence, it's no
True.
Joke for some people.
It is no joke to be flat on your back in bed for days feeling like you've been run over by a truck either.
Well, you know, to that point, we had a useful report from NPR this morning about how to tell whether you've got the flu or just a severe case of the common cold. One of the things that stood out to me in there, Carrie, was just sort of the way it hits you, you know, that if you can sort of
right.
slowly feel your head, you know, filling over a couple of days. Maybe it's just a cold, but
right.
if you get walloped all at once, perhaps it's the flu. What else should we be mindful of?
Right. Well, and also they noted, you know, higher fever tends to be flu, lots of body aches, really heavy coughing. It's a really respiratory disease.
And so what's the picture in Massachusetts in particular right now?
It is not a pretty picture. So here's Dr. Larry Madoff. He's the director of epidemiology and immunization at the Department of Public Health.
So the flu season is definitely picking up. It's well underway, and it's actually tracking very close to last season, which was a severe flu season.
So that's not good. We're looking like last year, which was awful. And in fact, in the final week of 2018, the little line on the flu graph spiked even a little bit higher than last year. But we're only now heading into what's usually peak flu season, and flu is notoriously unpredictable, so we'll see. Dr. Madoff points out another difference this year is the strain of flu that's dominant.
This season, the predominant strain in Massachusetts and most of the country is the H1N1 strain, whereas last year's season was mostly due to the H3N2 strain. So it's different. The H1N1 tends to affect younger rather than older people, but it can certainly be just as severe.
H1N1, that's that old swine flu that we heard about, right?
Just keeps coming back, H1N1, since the pandemic flu in 1918, actually.
Oh, wow. So mm-hmm. There's a lot of the centennial of that. How nice.
Yeah.
What a way to celebrate.
Yeah, still here.
So, you know, I understand that Massachusetts is kind of an early adopter on the flu season this year, too, right? You know, we're a national leader in so many categories,
yeah.
Carrie, and apparently this. But do we know why?
Yes.
I mean, what's going on here in the Bay State?
So we don't. I asked Dr. Brian Chow, an infectious disease specialist at Tufts Medical Center, and he says many factors may be at play in why Massachusetts seems to be rising early this year.
Sometimes it can be as simple as people traveling home from other parts of the country for the holidays. Sometimes it could be the weather and the conditions that are favorable for the virus to start replicating and persisting in the environment more. But it's a complicated interplay, and there's no one single explanation as to why it would be starting now and why we'd be being hit harder compared to prior years.
And Callum, I also asked Dr. Chow about some new research that's just out in the journal Pediatrics today about the nasal vaccine, also known as FluMist.
This is the one that gets squirted up your nose, right? Like Flonase? Okay.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
That's appealing to parents with kids, right, who don't want them to have a shot, or maybe some grown-ups, too, who are afraid of the needle?
Right, for anyone who doesn't like needles. But the thing is that, for the last couple, 3 years, the nasal vaccine has been very out of favor. And the new research just out today confirms that FluMist, which initially looked like it was more effective than shots when it came out, that was about 15 years ago, it came to be less effective than shots, at least here in the United States, though not in Europe.
Interesting. But you said at the top that the flu vaccine is not perfect in any form, right? So is the up-the-nose mist still considered a viable treatment?
It is, yes. It's a little confusing. So the CDC still includes it in its list of flu vaccines, and it expresses no preference for one vaccine over another. But the American Academy of Pediatrics did not recommend the nasal vaccine this year. And I can say, Callum, it's all pretty moot because you can't find this nasal vaccine hardly anywhere anyway. And I know because I looked.
It feels like the shingles vaccine conversation
yes, that we
just had.
It does. Yeah.
What would explain its diminished effectiveness?
So Dr. Chow says there are many theories, but it's not really clear. But, you know, the vaccine's maker has changed the formulation a bit, and the data on the new version is looking good in animals and in Britain. So he thinks there's a good chance it will be back again next year.
I think that we'll have to continue to watch and see the effectiveness of FluMist based on this year's data to see if it works. We can't really explain why there's differences seen around the world, but I think that we need to look at and make sure that in the United States that it is an effective vaccine.
And when I spoke to the lead researcher on that new study, Jessie Chung at the CDC, she said, you know, maybe the moral of this story is that it's just really important to keep an eye on how effective vaccines are and make sure that they're staying potent.
Well, this is one of the complaints that we hear a lot, right, about the flu vaccine as well. If it doesn't immunize me completely, then why bother if it's only 40% effective?
Right, right. So, you know, this year, what do we know about this year's effectiveness? Well, last year, the vaccine ended up being about 40% effective overall, which clearly is not ideal. But we should add, the vaccine also is known to reduce your symptoms if you do get the flu. On this year, here's Dr. Madoff from the Department of Public Health on the match between this year's strain of flu and this year's vaccine.
Both of those strains, the H1N1 and the H3N2 that we're seeing this year, closely match the vaccine. And so we're optimistic that the vaccine will be more effective this year.
So let's hope it's more effective, and let's really hope for rapid progress by the scientists who are working on a universal flu vaccine that you could get just once instead of every year.
Amen to that, and pass the Purell.
Yeah.
That's Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health. She is proud to be our in-house health nag, and thank you for being here.
And can I add one more thing, Callum, that you want to get vaccinated not just for yourself, but for the people around you to protect them.
Excellent point. Carrie, thanks again for being here. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.